For the week of December 22nd, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How y'all doing, Sperling?
You know, it's very funny you should have that accent on today's show.
Why is that?
Well, it's a Southern accent, correct?
Kind of.
And you're in the South, right?
Yes.
So then you might, sympathize with or at least understand some of the stories we're going to talk about today. Specifically, one story that I have in mind.
Well, what's that about?
Well, on today's show, we're going to be talking about what everyone else in America seems to be talking about, Duck Dynasty.
You mean the media?
The media, yes. And by everyone else in America, is there anybody else other than the media?
Apparently not.
Yeah.
Well, since we all blog.
Exactly. Well, the 67-year-old patriarch of the family that runs the Louisiana Hunting Supply Company, depicted in the A&E reality series, said a few offensive things during a recent interview with GQ, and now the show, and of course its hefty profit, might be in jeopardy. Michael, you apparently got all hot and bothered by some piece in the New York Times having to do with Paramount, so I'm going to ask you about that. During Inside Baseball, we'll discuss how sports are helping talent agencies expand their horizons, or at the very least, their business models. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right, and there's a lot of it as we move into the Christmas holidays. In North America, virtually every day from now until the end of the year is like a Saturday, a big movie-going day. So every movie will make lots of money. So don't get confused by opening weekends or where they are now. Since they just rake in money hand over fist, you got to wait till the new year to see where all these babies stand. But the number one movie around the world is Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, which grossed $127 million. It passed the $400 million mark, and it's moving fast. And number two around the world, holding really well, is Disney's Frozen, which made another $54 million. It's at $345 million worldwide. They still haven't opened in about a third of territories around the world, so there's a lot more money to be made there. At number three is Anchorman 2, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. I know that my nephews went to the movie wearing fake mustaches. So it was not a big opening, but the people who went were enthusiastic. It's made $40 million worldwide. It's at $53 million and counting. And number four is Personal Tailor. This is a Chinese mainland comedy. It's about a group of people who help clients realize their fantasies for one day. It's sort of like Fantasy Island. It made $24 million. It had a big opening weekend. It's at $35 million total so far. And number five is Walking with Dinosaurs. This is a live-action fictional film based on the BBC series that has been a series and an IMAX special and all that sort of stuff. When we were talking about holiday movies and why there were so few family films, this movie slipped through the cracks for me. I didn't realize it was coming out. I missed it completely, but people have been missing it in North America anyway. It had a very poor opening here, but worldwide, it opened to $21 million with terrible reviews. Unless your child is under 8 years old, they probably won't enjoy it.
Let's put it this way. You know, certainly my child is under 8 years old, or at least eight and below. I have two children of that age, and they loved the Walking with Dinosaur standee in the lobby when they went to see Frozen. However, they did not ask nor request to see Walking with Dinosaurs.
Ah, so you'll be hearing fewer poopy jokes in your household, I guess, in the next week or two.
I have no idea what that means, but okay, yes, I'll agree with that.
You don't? You have little children, you know what that means? And number six is American Hustle, one of the best openings of the season so far. It made $20.5 million worldwide. It's at $24 million and counting. This is a big Oscar hopeful, the biggest opening weekend for David O. Russell. Lots of acclaimed actors and stars in this movie, like Christian Bale and Jennifer Lawrence and on and on. So this is a really strong opening for a movie that's going to have great legs. At number seven is The Hunger Games: Catching Fire, another $20 million. It's at $765 million worldwide. At number eight, a little softer opening is Saving Mr. Banks. This is the Tom Hanks, Emma Thompson film about the making of Mary Poppins, how Walt Disney wooed the author P.L. Travers and convinced her to give him the rights to her books about Mary Poppins. It made $14.8 million worldwide. It's just over $15 million and counting because it opened 1 week earlier. Still pretty good reviews for it. Should have legs, a family film. But if you're looking for film number 19 of Tom Hanks to cross the $100 million mark in North America, this probably won't be it.
Well, you know, maybe they should have called it Saving Mary Poppins and it would have done better. I'm just saying.
No, you know. Oh my gosh, I don't know what this movie is about. I missed this one. The Attorney It is at number 9, and it grossed $11 million. It opened in one territory. I know nothing about it. That's what happens when you deal with the worldwide box office. Sometimes they throw you a loop. Any idea, Sperling?
I think it's a movie about somebody who practices...
the legal system.
Yes. Yeah. It's a legal movie. I want to say it's probably from China.
Well, you're just guessing. It could be South Korea. It could be anywhere.
It could be South Korea. It could be anywhere. You're absolutely right. I'm just going to repeat everything you say as if somehow that makes us smarter.
This is going to be a great show. At number 10 is Tyler Perry's A Medea Christmas. I can't remember. I learned how to say Medea, and now I'm forgetting again. Is it Medea or Medea? I don't know. It made $8.5 million. I guess I should have seen more of them. This one is doing softer than his earlier films. We might be nearing the end of the Medea train. It's made $28 million so far, so it's still going to be profitable. So I'm sure we'll see at least another one or two. And it will have a big Christmas day because it's a Christmas movie. And number 11 is Firestorm, another $6.7 million. That's at $38 million. And number 12, here's a big international film, Doom 3. Doom is translated basically blast. So it's Blast 3. It's a Hindi film. It grossed $5.4 million worldwide. 3.3 of that was in North America. It's the biggest opening for a Bollywood film in North American history. And it's off to a great start. It's a big franchise about two buddy cops. The villain is a big Indian star. So it's a, you know, it's a big franchise. It's looking to make a lot of money. And it's had a very, very strong opening. The first Bollywood film to be released in IMAX. There's a lot of firsts for this film, and there's one that I think that will interest Sperling the most. I don't know that it's the first, but it was released digitally only. No celluloid prints for this movie. And in fact, when they were talking to the industry and pitching the film, they said, go digital or miss doom. Because they did not want bootlegs of this movie out there. And for them, a lot of piracy occurs when you're shipping that celluloid print around. When you do it digitally, it's a lot more secure, a lot fewer hands touch the movie, and you can fingerprint it, you can watermark it, so you know where it went and who did it. So that makes it more secure. So they made a big push to make this film digital only, so with no prints of Doom 3. So even the Bollywood cinema is turning digital.
Well, yeah, I don't know about there being more piracy with celluloid because
this is what they said.
Okay, yeah, I don't know about
perhaps it's in the Indian market, but they said that's one of the big problems. That's where they have leaks, and just like Beyonce said, the reason she didn't release this physical CD right away is because if you go to a factory and you print CDs, it's going to leak out. Well, and they say the same thing in India for Bollywood movies.
That very well might be true in India. All the labs and all the duplication houses touching the masters and the inner negatives. I could definitely see that being a bit of an issue with, you know, too many hands on it and too many unsupervised hands and anywhere, not just in India. That's where you have leaks. Now, you asked about the attorney, and I think that certainly you're right, Michael. It was a Korean drama film. It had 1.38 million moviegoers. Now, as you might recall, a couple episodes back, Yoon-ha Choi wrote in. He is in Korea or South Korea. And he said, look, in South Korea, we don't measure by money, by financial figures. We measure by, you know, tickets sold.
Ticket sales. Yes. Yeah. God bless them.
And 1.38 million moviegoers in its opening weekend. It dominated at the local box office there. And it's inspired by a real story of Korea's former president. Oh, I don't want to butcher this. No Moo-hyun.
Why should it be any different than me?
Yeah, well, the movie centers around a small town lawyer, Mr. Song, who crazed about money, becoming the real attorney after observing a rational torture case of Jin Woo, an irrational torture case of Jin Woo, a son of a small snack bar's owner he owed a favor to before. So that's the...
I don't know if that description came across well.
I don't think so.
I imagine he found his calling and forgot about money and said, now I'm going to be a real attorney to save this poor person who's been treated unfairly. So surely that's the driving force of the movie.
Well, you can either take two things from this moment in time. Either A... the English translation of whatever news story this is not good, or B, you should become a screenwriter in South Korea.
Let's hope both are true. No matter what happens, we've got five more movies opening up Christmas Day, especially The Wolf of Wall Street and 47 Ronin, which just got a bad review in The Hollywood Reporter. That's a Keanu Reeves action film that cost a lot of money and is totally samurai oriented and didn't do well when it opened in Japan. So don't look for a lot of action from that one. But five movies are opening up, and unless they all flop, which isn't going to happen, Our 2013 box office is going to top the 2012 box office of $10.84 billion, which was a record. So yet another year where we'll have a record box office and probably a growth in ticket sales.
Yeah, so that is really what I'm interested in seeing is the admissions. And hopefully it won't be admissions derived from the average ticket price divided by the box
office. Well, we never get anything other than that, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because
we only get a very rough estimate of what admissions are, unfortunately.
Yes, exactly.
So now, I was going to have to eat a snail, wasn't I, Sperling? But it doesn't look that's going to have to happen, is it?
At least not yet. Not yet. Now,
no, not yet. We were talking about box office, but explain.
Well, a while back, and by a while back, I mean this summer, when Turbo was released and it opened to, well, what would you say, middling figures or horrible figures? I would say
middling,
horrible.
Middling. Pretty bad for North America.
Yeah. It grossed, $31 million during its opening weekend back in July. It was, you know, immediately everybody said, oh, it's a flop. And Jeffrey Katzenberg came out around that time and said, look, you know, it's going to do okay. It's, you know, certainly a disappointment, but it'll turn a profit. It's going to break even or turn a profit. And you said, if that movie crosses the $200 million mark, or was it $300
million? $300.
$300 million mark, I will eat a snail. And then somehow, I guess the movie opened in China or in some foreign territories. All of a sudden, it's making $15, $20, $25 million week in, week out. And it was inching closer and closer toward $300 million. Well, I don't think it's hit $300 million yet. However,
it's at $283 million worldwide.
So all snails are safe from Michael's dinner plate. However, I guess last week there was an earnings call and the DreamWorks Animation CFO, Luke Coleman, said, and this is a quote, "We believe Turbo is a profitable film. That assumes a successful performance in home video and consumer products." So I love the fact that he's like assuming that it's like, congratulations, you must work for the studio. Of course you assume that. You work for the studio. You don't go out going, well, we're going to assume we're going to make a really bad movie and lose all of our money.
Well, a couple things. First of all, we always emphasize wait till all the box office figures are in. The movie opened. People immediately said, oh, it's a flop. And I'm sure we said at that first opening week, well, you know, hold on, see what kind of legs it has, see where it ends up worldwide. They're gearing it towards Latin American markets. But in North America, it topped out at $80 million. That's very weak for a film that cost $135 million to make. It's done exceptionally well overseas. It's grossed 2.5 times what it did in North America. But that's still not enough to get it to what you usually expect, which is about 3 times what the budget is, 2.5, 3 times to try to get to profitability when you're looking at worldwide box office. So if it costs $135 million, you want to make at least $300 and perhaps more like $400 million to be in the black for theatrical. And of course, we know that that means the more successful you are theatrically, the more you sell on DVD and digital and all that. So overall, they got a TV series spinoff. They've got DVD sales to look for. They'll claw their way to the black, but this is not a raging success story. But look at worldwide box office, and it looks a lot better than it did when you saw it topping out at $80 million in North America. But happily, I don't have to eat escargot.
Not yet.
Not yet. Well, assuming it doesn't have any other countries. We're talking about worldwide box office, not about home DVD and streaming, you know, costs. I mean, they're saying toy sales might make up the difference. Well, sure, it's a successful property, not the launch of a franchise, unless the TV series does really well. But, you know, hey, they don't want to lose money. It's all better for them.
Well, since we're talking about franchises, do you want to talk about The Hobbit? Because I guess the only major market that it opened in overseas was in Russia, where it set an opening weekend record, actually, for Warner Brothers. It made $18.8 million in Russia over the weekend. And it's still The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug. I don't know however you pronounce that dragon's name. The movie is going to expand next week into Australia and I guess China and Japan will come around in February. So it looks like it very well could pass $1 billion.
Well, it's going to be a close call, but we'll have to see. North America's still doing well. We've got a big holiday still going on. It's number one at the North American box office, despite a couple movies opening up. They thought Anchorman might beat it out, but Hobbit came back strong. So yeah, this movie is going to do very well financially. No question about it. It's a very successful franchise, as has been Fast and Furious 7. That whole series has been thrown into disarray, of course, by the death of Paul Walker. They're trying to salvage the new movie. They've given it a new release date. They moved it from July of 2014 to April of 2015. So they're obviously going to have to rework things dramatically. They had a tight post-shooting schedule already, and so that's gone out the window. The screenwriters and director are trying to figure out what to do. How much footage can they salvage of Paul Walker? They want to keep him in the film in some way while being respectful and not being tacky and being able to make a movie that somehow makes sense. So it's a big problem, but they're going to work around it and make it happen. It's got a new release date. You'll have to wait longer, but they're going to salvage whatever they can and keep as much Paul Walker in there as possible.
Well, now, what I'm very interested in seeing is if they can pull this off and by April of 2015 without a lawsuit. And by lawsuit, I mean either Universal suing farmers. I can't remember the insurance company on this, but I think it was farmers, or I can't remember. I'd have to go back. Or Fireman's Insurance. Either way, this, if they have to do an insurance payout on this, it would be the largest in production insurance payout in the history of Hollywood.
Well, what is the previous largest installment? And why do we assume we know that this would beat it? We don't know how much reshoots they'll have to do. We don't know how extensive they'll be. We don't know what's covered in the insurance or what exactly they'll be able to get recompense for. Is it for lost profits? Is it for the cost of reshooting? What is it?
No,
because
if they
make this movie and release it and it makes $800 million worldwide, what's their insurance claim?
Well, no, then there wouldn't be an insurance claim. The only insurance claim that you might have to get is for reshoots at that point, and then it wouldn't be $150 million. The only reason that there would be a $150 million insurance payout is if they scrapped the film entirely and said, look, our budget was X, $150
million. Well, they've already said they're not doing that. Oh, you mean make an entirely new film?
Right.
Well, they've said they're not going to do that.
Right. And that's probably in part because they know that there'd be, you know, legal battles between the insurance company and Universal.
Well, this is what insurance is for. If they go over budget because they have to do a lot of dramatic reshoots and it costs them an extra $40 million, I would assume that that would be covered in the insurance. What else are you insuring except what if one of the actors dies and we have to do extensive reshoots? But I don't see why that would essentially necessarily be the highest in history.
I
think it's Hollywood hyperbole in that story. That's all.
Hollywood hyperbole. Hey, that could be the name of like a really good show or, you know, a podcast. Hollywood hyperbole this week on Hollywood hyperbole.
Saving Mr. Banks is the biggest flop in history.
You know what I loved about this week's box office actually was the fact that you had a ton of different headline writers who all went to the same headline.
What was that?
Bilbo beats Burgundy.
Ah, well, a lot of gotta love alliteration.
Yes, well, exactly. Hollywood hyperbole and Bilbo beats Burgundy. And, you know, Frozen, still chugging along there. It's made $344 million worldwide. And guess what? It's only opened in 61% of international markets.
That's what we said. That's right. It's still got a big ways to go.
Yeah, wow. So what do you think of, I guess, going back to Fast and Furious 7? Do you have anything more to say about that? Or are we throwing that one out at this point?
There's nothing more to say.
Well, the one thing I would say is don't count Fast and Furious out just because it's opening in April. Don't think, well, it's not going to be a big summer blockbuster. Yeah, I mean, Fast and Furious, I think four or five, one of them opened in April and was a huge success. It was one of the highest grossing April films ever.
Well, that's to say April. I'm sure it was a high grossing film period. You can open a movie any day of the year. January, February, March, April, May. I mean, we've long ago gotten rid of that shibboleth, if that's how you say that.
Shibboleth? Last week you had some other word that I didn't know.
I'm going to make that up.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Paramount, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, and you can't open a movie any day of the year if you're Paramount because you're only making like one or two of them. So you can only open a movie 2 days per year because you've made so few of them. And yet they manage to be so profitable.
Well, it's not so profitable. They just say they have a good profit margin. I mean, they're not the highest profitable Hollywood studio, are they? They're just saying they've been consistent over the past decade.
Right, precisely. And so why don't we tell people what we're talking about here? We're talking about this story that appeared in the New York Times. They did a profile on Paramount Pictures and Brad Gray, the head of Paramount Pictures, and I guess Paramount, really. And they are, I guess, as you say, Michael, insisting that less is more and that Paramount releases fewer pictures and has less of a market share than other studios like Warner Brothers or Sony or Fox. But their profit margins, as you just pointed out, are much
consistent.
Bigger.
No, consistent.
Consistent.
Consistent is the big thing that they're talking about, that they have consistent profit margins and they lay off a lot of the risk. And this is all for the good.
Right. And so what you're saying is what? The profitability itself is like a new measuring stick here in Hollywood?
That's right.
Well, the piece was written by Michael Siepley and Brooks Barnes. Who are the two, I suppose you could call them Hollywood beat reporters. They write about the movie business and the entertainment business. And talking about the success of Paramount's bottom line, they wrote, quote, it will also frame a troubling paradox. The less Hollywood does, the more it profits.
Right. That was one of their first things. which makes no sense. Why is it a troubling paradox? If it's a really good thing that Paramount is having, you know, consistent profit margins and doing more with less, why is that troubling? And if it's troubling, why are they praising them? So right at the beginning of the article, I'm confused.
Well, they also say that Paramount ranks last among major studios and even behind the mini major Lionsgate in every year's box office race. They kind of made under $900 million this year to date in domestic ticket sales, so that's North American ticket sales, down by half from its recent peak in 2011. And yet Paramount has become consistently profitable in an industry where profit margins have ranged from razor thin to non-existent.
Right. And again, I want to know, who else are they talking about? It's a very fact-free article. It talks about Paramount, but it does not compare them financially to other majors. Is Disney unprofitable? Is Warner Brothers unprofitable? Is Universal unprofitable? I mean, they're implying that these guys are making money and everybody else is barely hanging on or losing cash hand over fist. I don't think that's the case, is it?
Well, I mean, certain companies have had to take write-downs.
Such as?
Sony.
Okay.
Disney.
Well, what? Disney's in trouble financially with their movie division?
Their movie division has, there are times where it makes money, there are times where it loses money.
That's my point. That's what the film industry is. If you want a consistent, safe profit, go provide electricity to a local company and you'll make your 2% every year. But movies are a cyclical business. It's not a widget business. It's not a business that's going to have consistent returns if you're doing your job right. One year you release the third biggest film of all time. The next year you won't. Your profits will go up and down, but that's the nature of the business. It's not a bad thing. It's how the business works. You can't create, you know, consistent profits when you're creating a brand new thing every year. When you're doing cars, you know, you can sell a car for years and years and years and make new improvements. When you're making movies, everyone is new. You can make all the franchises you want, but you're still rolling the dice every time out. So if you're saying, oh my God, these people, it goes up and down. Well, that's okay. That's what happens. If you look long term, I think Disney's doing pretty damn good and a lot better than Paramount in their movie business.
Well, now let's look at this.
Would you want the profits of Disney or Paramount over the last decade? Disney.
Well,
no
Disney,
way would you want the profits of Paramount in their movie division. I'm not talking about everything else, in their movie division and the stuff related to that. You'd want Disney's profits. So why is Paramount the way to go?
Well, I'd like to look at the books, if I might. I don't have the figures in front of me. Now, this next point, I think, is really
This is what drove me nuts, and this is why we're doing the story.
Right. They kind of insinuate that the film business.
They state.
The film business is in survival mode. That's what they say. And they're saying that that's because there's changed viewing habits, a long decline in home entertainment sales, and fresh competition for viewers in rich foreign film markets like China, that these things are all taking their toll. Now, I know, Michael, you have a lot to say about this, so I'll let you go first, and then I'll probably come in here and see I'll play probably devil's advocate, maybe, depending on what you say, but go ahead. What are some of the issues you take with those statements?
Well, this is sort of a summary of the business, and these guys are covering the business for the New York Times, so they should know what they're talking about. But I wonder, how many mistakes can you make in one sentence? First, they say the film business is in survival mode. Well, I don't know why. Box office and total income from movies via cable, DVD, streaming, etc. are at record highs. We're having a new box office high this year, and as we've seen consistently over the years, movie attendance has increased every decade from the 70s to today. Every decade sees more tickets being sold to the movies than ever before, and then people go home and buy the movie on Blu-ray, or they stream it, or they download it to their laptop. So, you know, the pie is bigger than ever as far as movies are concerned.
Well, my only comment about that is, again, I have yet to actually sit down and do the, is our ticket sales keeping up with...
We've done that for years, Sperling. Come on, you know that. We've shown how every decade since the 70s, ticket sales have kept pace with population and have grown consistently every decade from the 70s. Anyone who says that box office or ticket sales are in decline is wrong. This is not a debatable point. We've proven that extensively over the years. Surely you can accept that.
No, I have yet to see those figures. I have not seen those figures. In fact, I've seen figures that are the opposite, but...
You're lying, right?
No, I'm not. I've actually seen...
What are you talking about? We've done ticket sales stories repeatedly over the last 4 years.
No,
you're telling me you're not sure whether ticket sales rose from the 70s to the 80s, the 80s to the 90s, and the 90s to the noughts? We've done that. You're now questioning the stories that we've done?
Yes, that is true.
Oh, okay. So you're just wondering about the teens. Well, the teens aren't over yet. It's only 2013.
We've
got 7 years to go.
I'm actually referring to more per capita ticket sales, but that's...
We've discussed that. It looks like ticket sales basically are keeping pace with population, even though people then spend extraordinary amounts of money buying movies on DVD and Blu-ray. So we've maintained ticket sales per capita, and yet we've also got people to pay a lot more money for movies after they leave the theater. They buy it on DVD or Blu-ray, and they download it onto their phone, or they pay to stream it via Netflix or some other service, or they rent it at Redbox or Blockbusters, which is now gone. But we've shown that repeatedly, Sperling.
Well, let me ask you this. Has the population in North America...
We have shown that it's keeping pace. It's growing, and that means it's roughly keeping pace with the population growth. We've done that. We've done that extensively. We've had long, hour-long episodes talking about that.
I was asking a question. The population in North America, from what I know and can remember, has gone up between, let's say, 2000 to 2010. I think it increased, I don't want to say significantly, but it increased. It didn't stay the same. It didn't plateau, let's say.
Nobody said it did. That's why ticket sales keep going up. It's not because people are going to the movies more often. It's because our population is growing and we're keeping pace with that population growth via ticket sales, even though people have more access and spend more money and time watching movies at home and elsewhere than they ever did before in history.
From the figures I have, 1.3 billion tickets were sold in, I think, 2000. And now I'm going from memory. And 1.4, 1.3, depending on the year you ask, the number of tickets sold, not the actual earnings, but the number of tickets sold were the same in 2010. In other words, there's been a plateau. That stayed the same.
2010 compared to what? 2009?
No, 2000.
Right. The population increased 27 more million people.
That's
it? Went from 281 million people to 308 million people in 2010, the last census. Will you accept that?
Yeah, well, okay, well, fine.
Okay, in census, we went up 27 million people, less than 10% in population from 2000 to 2010.
Who did the counting? No, just kidding. Well, look, we could spend...
I can't believe you went into this. We've done this 1,000 times.
All right, well...
You're telling me you don't understand this, that ticket sales have been increasing every decade? For whatever reason, ticket sales are increasing, right?
Yes, the number of ticket sales...
Is the film business in disarray? Are studios going begging hand... You know, are they like, you know, the PC computer business where nobody's buying anymore because everyone's buying tablets and laptops? No. Are people stopping going to the movies? No, they're going. And they're spending far more than they ever did before on movies.
Well,
is that all true? Yes.
I don't have... very easy to say that.
You've been listening to the show, haven't you?
Yes, but so what you're saying is DVD sales have been increasing. Because...
No, we didn't say that. What, are you out of your mind? Of course I didn't say that. Blu-ray sales are increasing. Streaming sales are increasing. Other areas are increasing. DVDs, after massive growth for many years, is now on the decline. It's slowly being made up for in other digital areas. Yes. No, they're not having the grand pile of cash thrown in their face like they did for about 8 years. That's slowing down, but that's not a sign of a business in disarray.
Well, what I would say, here's what I would have said about this if I had gone first.
Do you believe the film business is in survival mode?
I would have changed that.
That they are about to go out of business, that they are desperately trying to see, we're vaudeville, and we're worried we're going to disappear from the landscape. No one's going to go to the movies anymore. Do you seriously think that's the case? No, therefore, they're wrong. Say they're wrong.
I wouldn't have used
the word. They're wrong. They are wrong. Say, are they right or are they wrong?
I would not have used the word survival.
They're wrong. I know you wouldn't use the words because those words are wrong. Is the film business in survival mode?
I would have said
no. Yes or no? Yes or no?
Yes, and here's why.
Merry Christmas. Okay, here's the craziest part of this whole sentence. They say fresh competition for viewers in rich foreign film markets like China take their toll. Really? New customers going to the movies. Worldwide box office is exploding. There's no end in sight. They're getting tons of new customers. And this somehow is a bad thing. It's taking a toll. Oh, my God, we're making so much money overseas. What are we going to do? Where are we going to put all the money? What could they possibly mean by that?
Well, here's
fresh
what here's
competition for viewers in rich foreign film markets like China take their toll. Oh, no, we have more business.
Wait a second. I'll tell you exactly what they mean by that. And I don't disagree with what they're saying. What they're saying is normally we, Hollywood, would go into China and have the whole place to ourselves.
It's the whole world.
Right?
No, they are not talking about fresh competition. You're telling me they're ignoring the fact that Hollywood makes more money overseas than they do in North America, and that the sky's the limit, and that somehow, because other people are also making money, that's a bad thing. The worldwide box office is exploding. It's far more profitable than it was 30 years ago. Exploding, and it's not even close to peaking yet.
Well,
and you're
going
to somehow twist that and to say that's a bad thing because other people are also making money. And how come we don't get it all? We only get $30 billion of the worldwide market. That's not fair. No, that's ridiculous. The whole line, the whole sentence is about how Hollywood is in survival mode. And one of their examples is foreign markets. And to say foreign markets is a problem area for Hollywood is insane. Don't look at just China. Look at the entire world. They say foreign markets like China. We know the special difficulties in China. But I'm sorry, box office is exploding around the world. That's not a bad thing. That's not a problem for Hollywood.
Well,
and the competition is minimal. Hollywood still dominates every market they get access to.
Well, now can I go?
Sure.
Okay. A couple points. In the past, when Hollywood has shown up in a country, they have dominated. And by dominate, we mean 90, 95, sometimes 100% of
the market.
Which
is terrible.
Which I would agree, not good. Now, I'm going to stick on this foreign issue for a second, or the international issue for a moment. In the U.S., in North America, Canada and the U.S., we got multiplexed in the 80s. And we had a whole culture and a whole generation of people such as you and I, Michael, who grew up going to the movies where it wasn't just one movie that played in the single screen theater for a year and a half or 6 months. It was, you know, movie after movie after movie. And we had a steady diet of movies, and movie going became a part of our cultural heritage and cultural upbringing. That hasn't been the case in every country. In
Hollywood? France?
I'm saying
England,
in every country.
Germany? Australia? Spain? Japan, the second biggest market in the world? Please step in when you can tell me the country where people don't go to the movies. Unless they're really poor in the middle of China, which, you know, has hundreds of millions of poor people. Yes, I grant you the people on subsistence living don't go to the movies in the middle of Indian China, but those countries are growing by leaps and bounds. China has 400 million people in their middle class. They go to the movies.
Okay, yes. Well, that's kind of where I was headed, was to countries like Russia, like Brazil, like
Russia? Eisenstein, Russia does not have a history of cinema going.
No,
they helped invent cinema.
Those countries have been what the industry refers to as underscreened for quite some time.
I know. That's part of the glory of the future.
Precisely. So what I'm saying is, this is where I would... I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you, Michael.
Why are you not disagreeing with them?
What I'm saying
is absurd.
Well, and this brings me back around to that particular, I don't know what you want to call it, an adjective or a description of survival mode. Now, the way these Hollywood studios work and the way they've been organized and the way they run is they're huge behemoths. They are aircraft carriers and they consume a lot of fuel and they need a lot of resources. So by survival mode, that might be a wrong definition or wrong description.
Perhaps a wrong description for a multinational company making tons of money hand over fist, yeah.
What I would say is, gee, you're not engineered properly for this new market.
They're not engineered to do well in the worldwide market?
Well, in other words, you might be a little top-heavy.
Hollywood is not going to do well in the worldwide market?
By the way, they're seeing that themselves, and they're making those changes. Look at what just happened to Sony, saying we're going to be cutting back on our expenses.
That has nothing to do with the fact that box office is exploding overseas.
I think that the box office exploding overseas is a good thing. Here's why. Because much like we had at the 80s and 90s...
More money.
Well, it's more about a culture of movie going and a...
Yeah, there's a bigger market for movies. It's all good.
Right.
And Hollywood is going to dominate worldwide for a decade to come, if not more. If Japan can have good movies too, that's great. It's not a zero-sum game. Doesn't matter if Paramount has a big hit with Titanic. That doesn't mean Disney can't have a big hit with the Avengers. You don't lose. It's not like a car where somebody buys a car, they keep that car for a decade. If they go see Titanic one week, they can go see the Avengers the next week. So it doesn't matter if France has a big hit. It doesn't matter if Japan has a big hit. It's good because those directors end up coming to Hollywood.
Well, whether it be Brazil, Mexico, Russia, any place that
Alfonso Cuarón, often named as one of the top directors of the year.
I'm talking about a business. I'm talking about a business, and let me finish. Anywhere where there has been a classical definition of a country being quote-unquote underscreened and where the population didn't have access or easy access to the cinema, I think much like in the 80s where a generation was brought up on movies, you're going to have a generation brought up on movies in those countries, which is a good thing overall. Now, the fact that the cost of production has come down during that time and
not for blockbuster movies.
Not for blockbuster movies.
Right, which is what Hollywood excels at.
Right. That's just part of the business. And I think that the more people go into the movies, whether they're seeing Hollywood movies or indigenous movies, doesn't matter. A culture of movie going is what is the most important
thing. I'm pretty sure movie going is the dominant cultural invention of the 20th century. I'm pretty sure movie is pretty ensconced worldwide.
You don't think television is kind of up there?
Television's getting there, absolutely. But movies was around for 70 years before, 60 years before television really took heart. So I think movies was the dominant art form of the 20th century. Maybe TV is for the 21st. But anyway, let's get to the final comment before people fall asleep.
Well, happily, Mr. Gray said that Paramount recently sold Disney its rights to new movies in the long-running Indiana Jones series. Of course, we talked about that, I think, on the last episode or two episodes ago. And Disney, having acquired the film's producer, Lucasfilm, that made sense, they're going to be paying Paramount a fee based on revenue from all the new projects that Disney's going to create around the Indiana Jones franchise.
That's right. Could you comment on that? Brad Gray boasted to the New York Times in this profile, "Isn't that great? We just sold off Indiana Jones to Disney."
Yeah, I think that, quite honestly, if you're boasting about that, I get what he's saying. He's saying, gee.
Well, he's trying to make the best out of a dumb situation.
I get what he's saying, but at the same time, I think, you know what? If you're milking your cash cow and it's a declining cash cow, gee, you better figure out what your next cash cow is going to be. Because that's
why
the way.
Why is Indiana Jones a declining cash cow? Well, they're going to reboot that movie. Is Star Trek a declining cash cow? Is Transformers a declining cash cow? Why not sell them off, too?
And precisely. And that's what I mean, exactly. You're saying exactly what I'm saying.
Saying that that's ridiculous. Gray claiming, oh, isn't this great? We've sold off Indiana Jones as somehow a smart thing shows that, either he is too scared of the Hollywood business, to think that the best way to succeed in Hollywood is to have modest, consistent profits is to ignore how the industry works. You're going to have big year one year and a down year the next. And that's how it works.
But you need assets.
If you try to do it any other way, then you're in the wrong business. And you need assets like Indiana Jones or Star Trek to succeed if you're a big studio. And selling it off is a horrible thing to do.
Well, and I think, look, if you think Indiana Jones is so tied to Harrison Ford and that's...
No, it's not at all.
Let me finish. If you think that, okay... And you think Indiana Jones is kind of that whole ship has sailed and you just want to collect whatever you can collect out of Disney. Okay, fine. You get rid of Indiana Jones, you keep Star Trek, you keep Transformers. But here's the thing. You need something that's going to replace Indiana Jones. What is it that's going to, where is your next big asset that you're going to build? Whether it's something brand new that nobody's ever heard of, maybe it's World War Z. Who knows? But you have to, you just can't say, well, great, we sold off a property to some other studio and we'll just kind of collect residuals and dividends from that, because that's like collecting Social Security or a pension. It's never going to go up.
Right. They might as well retire. If you don't want to be in a business that's cyclical, get out. If you think the best way to succeed is to not be cyclical, to be modest and make tiny little profits with tiny little risk and tiny little ventures, well, great, but you're not in the movie business.
Well, let me ask you this. When A&E, the network, went to Louisiana and found the Robertson family, this family that makes duck calls, do you think they thought they were taking a risk?
No, they weren't taking a risk. These reality shows are very modest. They cost very little to make. There's been hundreds of them, and every once in a while, one clicks. I doubt A&E knew they had lightning in a bottle, but they did. And the show proved wildly successful. So do the Kardashians, and 1,000 other shows just like it flop.
Right.
Or have much more modest hits like Ice Road Truckers or whatever. So, you throw it all against the wall, you see what hits. It's one hit.
And this one being Duck Dynasty.
Yes. And this show, of course, is in the news because one of the family's patriarch, Phil Robertson, gave an interview to GQ and basically quoted scripture and talked about how gays are like bestiality and so on and created a huge uproar.
Well, there was also some racial comments made.
Well, I know. Those have been ignored. Those, to me, are far more offensive. Now, first of all, who is shocked that this guy thinks gay people are... He's not down with gay people. Are we really surprised by this?
Yeah, here's my big problem with the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
They are, and A&E basically has programmed and produced a television series, a reality television series that is meant to exploit and depict dumb redneck Louisiana Southerners.
I don't know if you watch the show.
I know they're quite smart, but I mean, but that's...
They're millionaires. They've got a very successful... They're very successful entrepreneurs. Now they've done a comedy show and made themselves wildly more successful. I don't know how dumb they are.
Comedy,
they may not have
reality,
your values or dress like you, but they don't seem to be particularly dumb. They're not geniuses.
Yes,
but,
however,
you know,
that's the
they're
way
not
that...
they're not nose picking yokels. They're guys who run a successful major business.
Okay. However, if you look at the show, they're not exactly portrayed.
I do watch the show. I've seen the show.
And are they portrayed as people running
the
business?
They're not portrayed as morons, no.
Okay, but they are portrayed as kind of like hillbilly-ish, correct? Southerners?
They're eccentric.
Redneckers. Yeah.
They've got alligators in their backyard.
Oh, right, okay.
They fart in their motor home. But, you know, they seem to know what's going on. They're having fun. They're seen at church on Sundays. They're seen working their business. They're seen squabbling. But they're not, it's not, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies. Well, the Beverly Hillbillies eventually outsmarted everybody, didn't they? They seem dumb, but they always outsmarted the fancy people in Beverly Hills. I think it's more akin to that.
Well, if you're trying to
They may seem dumb, but there you are. But anyway, I don't think there's any tension between putting them on the air and thinking, oh, my God, you know, they think hateful things.
What I'm saying is, if you're casting a dumb Southern redneck in this show and or others, and you're going to profit off of that, don't be shocked when they behave like a dumb Southern redneck.
Again, I don't think they were casting dumb Southern rednecks. I think they cast a colorful, eccentric family who were wildly successful at their business.
Well, okay, if you want to use your adjectives, fine.
It's not an adjective, it's a different thing. I don't think they were trying to portray them as dumb.
I think our listeners understand what I'm trying to say, which is, if you cast a fox, don't be surprised when it eats the chicken.
Well, how about saying, if you cast conservative people who aren't down with gays, don't be surprised conservative Bible-thumping people do not have very progressive views on gay people. Who's shocked and who cares? I certainly don't care. But what's fascinating about this was all the uproar. He made his comment. Why is he being interviewed by GQ? They immediately suspend him indefinitely, which I thought was an overreaction. They could have just said, we're concerned, we're upset, we're talking to him. But the new season's already shot. It's already almost completely done, basically. It's going to air. He's going to be in it. So why worry about something that's 2 years down the road? Just say, we're very unhappy. It doesn't reflect the show or the way he talks on the show. And, you know, we're going to talk to him and we're upset. Why suspend him? From what? The show's not even filming right now. So they created a problem for themselves where they didn't have to. They could just express their anger and upsetness. He immediately issued an apology. He didn't say, I love gay people now. But he said, you know, God can save them. But, you know, he said, I'm sorry, I love everybody, I would never encourage hate. Fine. But no, they said they suspended him indefinitely, which I thought was jumping the gun. Why bother? They could denounce it, say it's wrong, doesn't reflect them or the show or the family, and be done with it and say we'll be looking into it and talking to him seriously. Right? Why suspend him?
Well, I think the same.
They're going to air episodes with him in it. They're not going to cut him out. So, you know, they're just creating problems for themselves right now when they don't have to deal with it for like a year.
Oh, what you're saying is they've kicked the can? Gee, who else
does
that?
No, they didn't kick the can. They should have kicked the can. As a business, they should have kicked the can. Instead, I mean, you know they're not going to cut them out of the new season. They've already filmed it. So why create a problem when there's no need to? Say, well, yeah, kick the can down the road. That's what they should have done. Instead, we're suspending him indefinitely. Now the family says, well, we're angry. We're going to talk to them. We can't see the show without him. Cracker Barrel, which has a history of anti-black and anti-gay prejudice, incredibly hateful stuff, but new owners are in charge of Cracker Barrel. They overreact to go, we got to pull the Duck Dynasty merchandise off our shelves. Are you kidding me? There are people who go to Cracker Barrel love Duck Dynasty. So they deluged them with phone calls and said, what the hell are you doing? So they had to immediately retract. There's an online petition of 100,000 people saying, bring Phil back. You know, they shouldn't have had to bring Phil back from anywhere. They should have just condemned the comments, said they don't reflect the show, don't reflect him, and we're going to talk more later. You've got Sarah Palin, the governor of Louisiana, weighing in, and all these right-wing people going, we love Phil, he's the best, you're denying free speech.
Yeah, well, you're right, it is free speech, and he can say whatever he wants, and you don't have to watch him, and that's the way I feel. Like, let him say whatever he wants. 16 million people watch him every week.
He doesn't go on the air saying hateful things.
Right, precisely.
That's the whole point. The network says, yeah, but also free speech extends to the network. If suddenly he spouts hateful things in public all the time, they don't want to be associated with that. They have the free speech right to say, we don't want to be associated with him. But apparently, you only get to have free speech if you're filled with hate. I think they handled it very poorly. I think they created problems for themselves and an ultimatum where they didn't need to do it. And it's a big franchise, so why mess with it? You've already filmed the new season. Say, hey, look, we've already filmed the new season. He's in it. We're upset. There's nothing like that in this new season. It doesn't reflect us or the show or the family. And we're going to talk to him about it. But here's his apology. He loves everybody. And, you know, which certainly doesn't reflect us or the show. And nothing like that has ever, the show's never been a platform for hate and never will be. Boom. And we'll talk to him now because this season's already filmed. It's in the can. There's nothing even to talk about for a year. Convince him maybe to say something nicer somewhere, you know, then you're done.
First of all, I think you should be a publicist. You should be a PR flack. And in this week, you would have your choice of two different jobs. You could go work for A&E or you could go work for IAC, which is Barry Diller's company, which owns Match.com and all these things. And that's kind of an inside joke because, of course, Justine Sacco was literally sacked on her way to visit South Africa, where she's from, because she made some really poor joke.
She's from South Africa?
Or her aunt, you know, basically her family is from South Africa. But she made some poor Twitter comment about...
Well, she said, I'm going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding, I'm white.
Yes. Then she got on a plane.
A lack of medical knowledge. And this went out just as she got on a plane. And for hours, everybody was dealing with this. This is the new world where everything reacts so quickly. People suddenly had tweet countdowns to when her plane would land in South Africa. And she'd find out what had happened. And people were like, good luck with that new job. Whatever. So you find out this executive at IAC made this stupid racist comment and got in huge trouble for it, was fired immediately. And then you find out the kicker for me is she's their communications officer.
That's the worst part.
That's like the fire marshal, you know, setting off smoke bombs in the office. I mean, what the hell? And Steve Martin made a tweet that was offensive, like today, and that's in the news. He immediately pulled it down and apologized, realized it was in poor taste, made the joke, realized he shouldn't, apologize. People are like, it's not enough. You know, I'm sure he'll recover. You know, I think you should always take a breath. Immediately get ahead of it, apologize, do whatever you need to, but don't jump the gun with ultimatums and demands. You know, look at what your situation is. Everyone is different. You know, for Duck Dynasty, this new season was in the can. He's going to be on there. So
do you know that Duck Dynasty, for A&E and for that family, pulled in $400 million in revenues, not from the show itself, but from merchandising of the show. And that might be an underestimate.
Is that strictly of the show, not counting, because that might include their duck calls?
No. That's the stuff that they sell at Walmart and everything like that. And apparently Walmart can't keep this stuff in stock now after this whole kerfuffle. And so, yeah, $400 million in Duck Dynasty, the show, merchandising.
Right. It's a big, big product and all the more reason to be careful with it. You know, and why immediately alienate the family when you don't have to? Why suspend him when it's a meaningless gesture and say forever, indefinitely? Why do that when there's no need to do it and it doesn't serve any purpose? And all it's going to do is, endanger your franchise. They're like, we'll go somewhere else with our show.
Well, then let me ask you this. Okay, so that's television, right? And that's, you know, you're saying, look, just, you have very...
No, Kat, take a breath, look at your specific situation and act accordingly.
So, you know? So that's A&E...
If he's the Grand Imperial Wizard of the KKK, you got to cut your losses. But he just said something that nobody should be surprised that he said. Gay people are sinful and going to go to hell, but Jesus can save them. Well, good God, if he didn't say that, I'd be shocked.
But he did finish with, now excuse me, I have to go to church.
That's right. You know, we didn't even tell his racist comment. To me, this was far worse. It got totally lost in us. I mean, this shows his, you know, you said he was a dumb Southern redneck. Well, he's certainly he's certainly ignorant. Look at his comment about real life. He says in pre-civil rights Louisiana, he never saw any mistreatment of any black people ever. Wow. What a halcyon world he lived in. And he says pre-entitlement, pre-welfare, you say, were they happy? They were godly. They were happy. No one was singing the blues.
He also
black folk were happier when they had no rights. And that got lost. That's the world we live in, where anti-gay is more of a firestorm than anti-black.
Well, and he also readily admits that he was pretty much in a drunken stupor until 1973. So,
that's right, when he was saved by Jesus.
Correct.
Enough of that.
Well, okay, so that you're telling A&E what they should be doing, and maybe even IAC. I don't know whether you would have, not fired Justine Sacco there. But what do you think Target and Amazon should do after Beyonce releases her album? Huge surprise, December 13th, she releases the album to everyone's shock and awe. And then, only digitally, only on iTunes. What do you think Target and Amazon did?
Well, that's how she kept it a secret. She obviously thought if she went to all of them, to Target and Amazon, and said, I want to release this album digitally, that it would have gotten out. And so she went with one outlet only for safety reasons. But the problem is, now she's ticked off all these other people. Her last album, barely went platinum in America. So if she sells 600,000 copies in the first week, that may be the vast majority of her sales, and they weren't allowed to take part in them. So Target and Amazon say, oh, you want us to carry your physical CD now that you've already had a bunch of your sales first week? No. If you give someone else an exclusive on your album for a week, we're not going to carry it in any format. I think it's a reasonable business decision, and it's a hard one because, she had a big game plan with Target on her last album. They were partnered to the neck. They had a bonus album with lots of extra tracks. She did all this sort of stuff with Target. And so for them to say, screw you on this album, that's they had a fruitful relationship, but obviously didn't do well enough to get her to give them her digital copy. She didn't say, well, I want to go with Target on my exclusive digital. I want to go with iTunes. So, that business relationship is gone. And I guess it's always an album by album basis, but hey, you give someone else an exclusive on your album digitally or physically or in any way for a week or a month, we're not going to carry it. You've already given away most of your sales anyway, probably.
Well, I think you mentioned that Beyonce's last album back in 2011, I think it was called Four.
That's correct.
She did a TV commercial, and it was for her album, which she put in like additional bonus tracks. I think if I'm not mistaken, she said something to the effect of I give my all to you. I put so much into my new album, and only Target gives you all of it. And that was like a big deal. And now, of course, none of it
is at Target.
But
I mean,
but
I don't know what else they can do. They want to say, look, you got to pay a price when you don't give us access to your new album, especially after what we did with the last one. You're going to give it to someone else. The only way we can make you pay a price is to not carry it.
Right. And Amazon is saying, we're not going to carry the physical album. We will only carry the MP3 album. So you can only buy the MP3s at Amazon.
They are doing that.
You can't buy the physical album. But if you were to look at it, if you were to take a step back, okay, and you were Beyonce, putting her shoes on for a second, which I might say I'm not very good in high heels.
You would probably fall.
Yes, I would. Let's look at what Billboard estimates the sales are. iTunes, the largest seller of music in the United States, with 41%. Of the market.
The largest seller of digital music.
No, largest seller of music, period. 41%.
I thought Amazon was the number one retailer. Okay.
41% of the market in 2012. Walmart had 10%, Amazon 9%, and Target 5%. So really, she looked at that and said, you know what? I'm going to lose 14%. I think I can do that.
I don't think she expected to lose that.
Well, okay, fine. That's
and
true.
As far as physical CDs, she's losing 100%. Because iTunes doesn't sell physical CDs. So anybody who wants to buy her physical CD, it just became a lot harder. You can't go on Amazon. You can't walk into Walmart. You can't walk into Target. That's a big pain in the neck.
Well,
that's a lot of sales. That's 100% of your CD sales. I'm exaggerating, of course, but you know what I mean. You're endangering all of your CD sales from people who don't want to do a physical download. So anybody over 30, forget about it.
So I don't understand. Is this, important? I don't understand whose side you're taking here.
I'm not taking a side. I'm saying that they took a reasonable step in order to punish her for keeping them out of the digital rights to the album on its first week. Giving an exclusive to iTunes, you got to pay a price.
I threw a softball at you to get us into Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Oh, you want me to say it's a big... I think it's a big deal that they're blocking her out.
Amazon and Target are blocking her out.
That's right.
Well, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story must be a big deal because it's about Harry Potter. He is going to be coming to the stage. That's right.
Yay!
Daniel Radcliffe. Oh, I'm sorry. No. J.K. Rowling will co-produce, oversee, and collaborate with a playwright, but not write it herself, a stage play based on the life of Harry Potter before he came to Hogwarts. So as an embryo, let's say.
Ooh.
So it won't be a magical fantasy with lots of stagecraft to recreate Quidditch and the like, but a drama about a little boy with unloving in-laws, where he has to live under the stairs. Nonetheless, there's intense interest, and Warner Brothers will also be involved in some form or fashion or way. They're eyeing a West End production in London, maybe 2 years from now. It also has top producers involved and has been gestating for a year now. Needless to say, Rowling has been approached about a stage production, but this drama about Harry before he became a wizard was the first one that made sense to J.K. Rowling. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I think it's very consistent. It's what she's been doing. She created the Harry Potter books, and she's clearly willing to explore that world that she created on the margins, whether it's the Salamander spinoff of the guy who hunts down magical creatures. That's becoming a movie that she's helping write the script. This is a stage production, not of the books, but of, you know, an earlier part of Harry's life that we haven't seen before. So she says, all right, what makes sense on the stage? Should we recreate the magical wizardry and do Quidditch? No, we should do something different that expands that world, makes use of the world I created, but does not encroach upon the Harry Potter's tales that we've already told. So I think it's consistent. I guess it's smart. She certainly knows what she's doing. Someday, of course, we'll have a Hogwarts TV series. Kids will be going to Hogwarts to become wizards. Be nothing to do with Harry Potter per se, but it will be set in that world, and it will perhaps make a lot of money.
Well, now, this next story, the first three words always make me raise my eyebrows and go, oh, geez, what are we in for? And they are actor Shia LaBeouf. You see the first.
Okay.
Well, he debuted a short film at Cannes last May, or 2 Mays ago. It stars Jim Gaffigan as an online film critic, which, you know, there aren't too many of those. You couldn't have cast a real one. When LaBeouf posted the short called HowardCantor.com online, it caught the attention of fans of graphic novels. The short is a virtual adaptation of a piece by famed writer Daniel Clovis that came out in 2007. That's when the graphic novel was published. To compound the issue, LaBeouf issued a half-hearted apology in which he defended his film not as a copy, but as being inspired by Clovis. But even his apology was apparently plagiarized by an earlier, that's right, apology. Now, wait for it. There's more. LaBeouf also published some mini comics and attended Comic-Con to promote them. But those were ripped off substantially from Benoit Duéter's graphic novel. The Little Girl and the Cigarette was the name of that novel. Even the text for the About section on LaBeouf's website was lifted from Picturebox, a New York-based indie comics publisher. Legal action is being considered, and Shia LaBeouf is now living in a cave. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. This always happens. You find out somebody plagiarized something, people look, and suddenly they find it everywhere. It's rarely just a one-time thing. And this is substantial plagiarism. This is embarrassing. He ripped off the About section of an indie publisher. They said, this is our company, blah, blah. He said, this is our company, blah, blah, blah. He just ripped it off. He has a problem. I mean, these are minor things. There's no commercial juice to them, so it's not that sort of an issue, but it is a legal issue, and he's going to pay a price. And you know, he's clearly got some issue he's ripping off people left and right. I mean, these are substantial. This isn't like, oh, it's a similar story. It's like dialogue, you know, setup, everything. It all seems to be very, very bad.
Well, he should do what most people in Hollywood do when this happens. They immediately put out a press release through their publicist saying that they have gone into rehab and will be joining Plagiarizers Anonymous.
PA. Right. Unfortunately, he'd be ripping off Liza Minnelli's same statement when she did the same thing.
Exactly. So.
It won't hurt his film career as such, but it is embarrassing and sad.
Well, even Xbox is getting into original programming. The gaming device is moving into creative content with a documentary series from the Chin Cousins that explores a quirky story in the early days of video games when Atari reacted to horrible reviews of its E.T. video game, get this, by burying millions of cartridges in an isolated location. And that is absolutely 100% true, by the way. They put them in an old school bus and then buried the whole bus. Now, there's like a whole thing, a whole like quest to find where the bus is buried. Zach Penn, who has writing credits on The Avengers and the TV series Alpha, will direct. Simon Chin, the Oscar-winning producer of Searching for Sugarman and Man on Wire, will produce along with Jonathan Chin, What's next? Original programming from your phone in your fridge? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, but it's amazing. Everybody wants original programming. Like, literally, my electric toothbrush is going to do a TV series. So, I mean, it's bizarre. But I'm thankful these guys are doing this because it led me to this story about this E.T. video game. Apparently, of course, the movie was an out-of-nowhere hit, and everybody suddenly was scrambling to cash in. Fortunately, it stayed in theaters for like a year. I'm not exaggerating, a year. It was in theaters forever. And so they had time to put out video, you know, t-shirts and merchandise and toys and games and all that stuff. And one of the things they put out was a video game. They coded it in 5 weeks, and it's apparently one of the most hated video games of all time. It's so hateful. The only thing good about it, people say, is like the cover art or something. I mean, it's literally awful. And this crazy story about it, I knew none of this, so I loved reading up on that.
There was like a Kickstarter campaign about, you know, fund us and we'll find the video game, you know.
That's all. Well, that's what they're doing in this series. They're going to dig it up.
Right. Listen, do you want to know a secret? Do you promise not to tell anyone? Well, it has to do...
You can't add it in anyone. It's a Beatles song. Listen, ooh-ah-ooh, do you want to know a secret? Ooh-ah-ooh, do you promise not to tell? Whoa-whoa-whoa, closer. No?
Oh, you see, without the musical notes next to it, I didn't know that those were actually lyrics.
Okay, so what's the secret?
Well, it has to do with copyright.
Okay.
Foolish laws that keep works that should be in the public domain in the hands of major corporations sometimes have a good effect. The Beatles were sitting on some curiosities, early studio recordings and BBC performances that they had never released, though the various tracks had been bootlegged over the years. But time was running out. If the record label Apple didn't commercially release them soon, the music would fall out of copyright and anyone could sell copies, which is precisely what I was planning to do. I had my sandwich board and everything. I was going to go out on the street and do that. So the label Apple turned to the iTunes company, Apple, that's right, and released dozens of tracks. Now, this means the music will be under copyright for another 20 years. Now, they only released it for 4.5 minutes. No, I made that part up. But at least fans get to hear
it. I bought it.
At least fans get to hear it now. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. This is just curio stuff. The sort of things that would be bonus tracks in a box set. But, you know, I'm glad it's out there. And it proves how good the Beatles are, how they did not, you know, exploit their catalog and dredge up every, you know, spare track to try to cash in. They've really been very parsimonious over the years. They released the albums as good quality as they could. They waited like 20 years before remastering them. They waited a long time before putting out a mono version. I mean, some people put out their albums out every 2-3 years, remastered. Here's a new Elvis Costello tortures his fans. You know, one version will have a new studio track. Another version will have a new live track. Another version will have a new B-side. Another version will have a B-side from Australia. You know, you just have to keep buying them over and over if you want all the different little bonus stuff. At least the Beatles never did that.
How could you be down on Elvis Costello?
I love Elvis, but I don't like the way he reissues his CDs.
Unbelievable. Well,
remember, I didn't drive over him. I could have run him over, and I didn't do that.
Yeah, and if you want to know what Michael is talking about, go back a couple episodes to the moment where Michael almost ran him over in the streets of New York. By accident. By accident. You know, I have to say, Michael, really nothing succeeds like failure.
Hey, we're kings of the world.
Wait a second. Speak for yourself. I resemble that remark. Now, you know what that's from, right? I mean,
yes.
Okay, that's an old... You know what? You really are up on your Three Stooges if you know that one. Katie Couric's talk show was a big flop in syndication, almost immediately outpaced by the Steve Harvey Show. Producer Jeff Zucker left on bad terms midway through the first season, and that meant Katie Couric wasn't interested in talking to, say, CNN about what would surely be an ideal role there. Instead, she's headed over to Yahoo and a big raise. Yes, Couric will go from making $5 million a year to $6 million a year for the website. Meanwhile, with the season finale of The X Factor dropping some 45% from last year, Demi Lovato is leaving the show, The X Factor. And Simon Cowell, remember him? He's saying he may play some other role rather than judge. One has to wonder why Fox would bring it back next year at all. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, the Katie Couric is just confirmation of what we already suspected, so that's a big whoop. The X Factor, I mean, Demi Lovato leaving, that, you know, she was there for 2 years. Simon Cowell saying, maybe I won't be a judge. I really don't see the purpose, but they had a great season, a lot of quality. The winning act could very well become a commercial act. A few others could click as well. So it's a shame for them. They put out a good product, but it just didn't work. Too much space, too many talent shows on the air.
Marvel has turned its comic books into a movie franchise that every studio is lusting after. Warner Brothers wants to recreate the magic of individual franchises leading into a mega franchise with its DC Comics world. Disney just bought the Marvel Universe outright. And now Sony is taking the most popular Marvel character of all time, Spider-Man.
No. Spider-Man.
Oh, I'm see. I see what you're trying to do, because Spider-Man, turn off the dark. And you see, but without the turn off the dark, it doesn't read as kind of, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
Well, they want to, Sony, that is, they want to give him the same treatment. They want to bolster him because, you know, he's just not making enough money. Sony has hired a team of top writers to expand the Spidey universe because it really needed expanding. The second Spider-Man movie with Andrew Garfield comes out in May. They're writing the script for a third one, and Spidey 4 has a release date in 2018. Gotta love that. They haven't finished the third movie yet, but they're already picking release dates for the fourth. But the villains are coming on strong. Venom is getting his own movie, and the Sinister Six, a Super Friends villain of villains like Sandman, Mysterio, and Dr. Octopus, they're gonna get their own movie as well. Fox is happy with the big success of Wolverine and wants to push X-Men much farther and relaunch the Fantastic Four. Bad idea. While they're at it, is this a big idea or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. I mean, it's a franchise and they're going to exploit it as much as possible. It's weird with Spider-Man, though, because basically you're talking about the villains. It's not a world of heroes. It's a world of villains because you got Spidey and you got all these colorful villains. I've always thought the villains were the weak part of Spider-Man, but maybe I'm wrong, so we'll have to see.
Well, there's a reason that you don't see a movie, surrounding just Darth Vader. Well, I guess actually you would call that...
That would be awesome!
That would be the prequels, actually.
Yes, right.
Despicable Me 2, the animated hit from Universal, sold a ton of copies when it came out on home video. I say home video, but that's about the only format it's not available in. The movie was sold on DVD and Blu-ray, as well as in digital version. The franchise took in $80 million its first week, and Universal says that sales of digital downloads of the movie were the largest of any movie ever, and on track to be the biggest selling release in that format ever, until next week when some other movie beats it out. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. It was a big movie. We knew it would be a big seller in digital and DVD. And like you say, it's just breaking into a new format. So that record will be beaten next week. And obviously with, you know, $1 billion from Despicable Me 2, Universal is in survival mode.
Well, didn't they produce The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, or was that Sony? I think that may have been Sony. I don't know. But The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is going to be returning. Like James Bond, you can't keep the enigmatic Lisbeth Salander down. Her creator, Stieg Larsson, died after writing 3 books in what he saw as a 10-book series. They've sold 73 million copies and resulted in several major films. But squabbles between his partner and his family mean Larsson's work on a 4th book is tied up in legal rights. That won't stop his publisher, however. They've hired writer David Lagercrantz to write the newest chapter in the saga. His partner, Eva Gabrielsson, has denounced the project since it uses none of his notes, outlines, or the manuscript that was 3/4 of the way complete. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal because it's a huge franchise. You figured they're going to do something to do it. It's a shame because 3/4 of the book is done. So it's a shame they couldn't all come to terms and they're just going to move ahead with this one because that will eventually come out. But, you know, if there's more room for Lisbeth Salamander to play, they're going to do it.
Salamander? And by the way, don't you mean Salander?
Salamander. That's her evil villain twin sister. Sorry about that.
Well, that character is going to get their own franchise in about 30 years.
Salamander versus Aquaman.
Right.
It was a Sony film. It was a Columbia MGM Scott Rudin thing.
Okay, well then, I was wrong. But that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Well, Sperling, this is for you. You're going to analyze it because I have no idea what's going on. So I'm going to agree with everything you say.
Well, first off, the per capita income from...
All right. So this is a story about the agency business. The agents, those people that go around and represent the actors, the directors, the writers, you name it. There's a brash agent at William Morris extends reach in IMG merger. I'm already confused. William Morris Endeavor, working with its private equity partner, Silver Lake Partners, beat out 2 other groups with an offer of about $2.3 billion to purchase IMG. And that means when they combine, they will be the biggest mega agency in town, leaping well ahead of CAA, also known as Creative Artist Agency. So William Morris Endeavor bought IMG. Now they are the big kahuna crushing CAA. They will be the biggest name in town.
And thanks for listening this week. If you want to subscribe to the show. No, just kidding.
So what does that mean and why do we care?
Well, the reason you'd care is because, well, first of all, I just so you know, Michael, I did see I'll Eat You Last starring Bette Midler. Which, did you see that play?
I did. I saw it on Broadway.
And if I recall correctly, you didn't like it.
I thought it was, I didn't hate it. It wasn't a good show particularly, but I enjoyed Bette Midler. It was fun seeing her live. It was not a good show, though.
It is a show that probably can't play outside of New York and Los Angeles because it's about Sue Mengers, the former William Morris agent. She was a legendary agent of Barbra Streisand and Ally McGraw and a ton of others. Bette Midler did a bang-up job. And people ate it up. It's an industry town. So,
did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, yes.
Cool. Were you close enough? Was it all right?
Yes, I was very close and, not spinning distance, but close enough.
Cool.
But that said, here's the issue. William Morris Endeavor, it used to be called the William Morris Agency. Endeavor was a completely different agency that was created by Ari Emanuel. That was Ari Emanuel and four fellow agents left ICM, another talent agency, in the middle of the night one night, 1994, 95, and started their own agency, Endeavor. William Morris Endeavor merged a couple years back, and Ari Emanuel wound up on top leading this company, William Morris. He now leads it with Patrick Weitzel, who I used to work with at Creative Artists Agency.
Boy, did you take the wrong career path.
Well, Patrick Weitzel, like Ari Emanuel, left CAA in the middle of the night and went and joined Endeavor, and that's how both of those people, both of those agents, wind up at what is now called William Morris Endeavor. Now, talent agencies cannot produce content. They're not allowed to own and produce content because it's a conflict of interest. You can either represent the talent and sell the talent services to content producers, but you cannot produce that content yourself because then you'd be selling to yourself. So the problem that talent agencies have is that they have no hard assets. Their assets are
their clients,
and really their clients have lifespans literally. And so slowly, Creative Artists Agency and others, William Morris Endeavor now, have been looking to expand their businesses. And one way to do that is through purchasing other agencies or getting into entirely different yet similar businesses. And so CAA, a couple years back, got into the sports representation business, representing athletes, not only in their sports
contracts. And they have a writer's division too, don't they? I mean, not just Hollywood, but like novelists, don't they do some of that too?
Yeah, a little bit, but not that much.
Yeah.
And so they're representing all these athletes to their teams and also, more importantly, into their endorsements and all of the franchises that spin off from like a Tiger Woods, or maybe that's a bad example these days, but
it's a good example.
Still
made a lot of money off endorsements. So William Morris Endeavor looked at them and said, damn, we want to be in the sports agent business. And so they looked at IMG, which is really big in sports agency, and they said, we're going to swallow them up. Now, in one fell swoop, we get bigger by buying another company, and we're not just doubling down on Hollywood movie actors and directors. We're expanding into the area of sports people, and that's where the growth industry is at the moment for the agents.
Right. Now, what they're also looking at is, hey, we kind of know a little bit about TV and sports on TV. The money's there. There's a lot of money being pushed around for sports on TV.
But the athletes don't get it. The athletes do not get the sports money on TV. That's got nothing to
do with it. However, IMG represents the NCAA, which is the National Collegiate Athletics Association here in the United States. So they don't just represent athletes. They represent leagues. And
all right, well, the schools, that's where the money is, yeah. Because unless you represent the New York Yankees, you're not getting any TV money. Derek Jeter can have the biggest contract in the world and the biggest endorsements. He doesn't make any TV money.
Correct. Well, but ultimately, the TV money flows through to his contract.
Through his salary.
But, yeah. But right, so what they're realizing is, gee, with, the film business, what did you call it, in survival mode, Michael, you said it was
That's the New York Times.
I'm sorry.
The film business. $50 billion. Oh, my God.
But, the studios are definitely looking a little bit more closely at the books, and they're trying to spend less. And by spending less, that means they're going to be paying creative talent less. And if they're paying creative talent less, that means that agents themselves, which only make 10% of whatever the talent is making.
Malarkey!
They're going to be paid less.
Malarkey! Tom Cruise isn't getting paid less. Just because he takes profit participation rather than a flat fee up front doesn't mean he's suddenly going to get $5 an hour for making a movie. He still gets $20, $30, $40 million. Tom Hanks, you know, Saving Mr. Banks may not be a big hit, but, you know, this movie cost $35 million. Sure it did, because he gets a big cut of the back end, and his agent gets a part of that.
Okay, so let me ask you this.
And a studio that's scaling back a little bit in movies right now is expanding in television because there's so many more opportunities in cable and worldwide to make and remake your franchise. The CSI's worldwide, Law & Order's in every country in the world. So there's money to be made in the entertainment business everywhere.
Yes, I agree, especially in television. In fact, that's where most agencies make most of their money. The film business is for the prestige and for the glamour and the glitz. And the reality is they're lucky if it breaks even. The television business, with all of its packaging, is where all the money is.
So this deal means, all right, it tells us sports is really a big, important part of agencies. That's where a lot of money is being made right now. The big are just getting bigger. Anything else?
No, that's about it. Kind of like us, the big are just getting bigger.
Hey, I'm about to enjoy my holiday dinner.
Oh.
And when other people are enjoying their holiday dinner and they want to write us or call us or email us, what do they do?
They can write us or email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. A special shout out to Captain Ron Marin for his kind email to us last week. I'm not going to read it. It was a fairly lengthy, but Captain Ron Marin, thank you very much. And I guess if you want to call us, you can. You can call and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. A special shout out to all the fax machines that have been calling that number and leaving 9.5 minute fax machine messages. That I'd like to thank you for doing that. Now, we got a big
demographic. We got the fax machine demographic covered.
That's true. Yes. We also have VHS tapes covered as well. Now, if you want to subscribe to the show, you can do so in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, Downcast, anywhere they give out podcasts for free or anywhere they aggregate or list or any directory with podcasts. That's where we can be found. You can also subscribe directly to our show on our website, which is showbizsandbox.com. And that's also where you'll find ways to follow us on Twitter, where our username is showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, where if you search for showbizsandbox, guess what? Our page should show up. Links to all of the stories we talked about and or argued about today can be found on our website. Again, our website is Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com.
When's our next episode? Yeah.
Good point, Michael. We will not be having an episode next week. So
It's Sperling's fault.
It is my fault, but we will be starting up at the very beginning of next year, January of 2014, we'll be covering the Sundance Film Festival. Michael, you have a website, and every week it always amazes me how you're able to move it around from domain name to domain name. What is it this week?
It's survivalmode.com.
That domain may be taken. So if you get to that domain and it's just nothing having to do with Michael, try michaelgiltz.com or even bookfilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com or my Tumblr account, sperlingspeaks.com. Until next year, play nice.